Are you ready to make the most of your oil and gas mineral rights? Welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. Get the knowledge and resources you need to manage your minerals and royalties. Here is your host, Matt Sands.
Hello and welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Sands, and I'm here to help you make the most of your mineral rights and royalties. And Justin Williams joins me as well. Hey, Justin.
Good morning, Matt. Thanks for having me as always.
Yeah, thanks for your help. And today we're going to give a little bit of an update on what the market is doing as far as oil and gas prices, the demand for oil in the future, and, you know, sort of the outlook for minerals and royalties given all of this. So I know there's been a lot of stuff in the news, and we've talked about it quite a bit, Justin, as far as renewable energy and this big push to a net zero energy future.
We have, and it, you know, it's going to be a part of the future. We've decided that, but the question is, how is oil and gas going to play a role, and how realistic is that role moving forward as we get there?
Yeah, how realistic is it? And really, what's the continued demand for oil and gas going to look like? And certainly oil and gas is not going away anytime soon. We have globally a really significant dependence on oil and gas as a cheap and reliable source of energy for both power generation, as well as transportation, and then also all the myriad of products. You know, and we're talking right now, I'm using two computers. I have a monitor, a keyboard that's plastic, you know, my microphone stand, which is made from steel. And so it's like all these things take energy to produce. And then, you know, a lot of them are directly using oil, you know, to make plastics and things like that. And so we have a heavy dependence on oil and gas for our lifestyle and our standard of living in the Western world and the developed world. And so, you know, I don't see it going away anytime soon. What do you think, Justin?
No, I don't think it's going to go anywhere anytime soon. It's something that we've become so accustomed to.
Yeah, and we need that reliability. You know, it would be a shame if we gave that all up just for the people that are claiming that we're going to have some catastrophe from a climate standpoint, and we need to act now and do something before we're ready from the standpoint of the technology to get there from a reliability and affordability standpoint for the cost of things like wind and solar and having reliable backups for those. You know, I'm in the boat, like I've mentioned many times on the show, of we should focus on an all of the above strategy. And honestly, if CO2 emissions is a significant concern, then we need to be talking about nuclear power more. You know, it seems like there's a huge opportunity there. We're only producing about 10% of the world's electricity from nuclear. It has zero carbon emissions, and, you know, it's affordable, it's reliable. You know, that needs to be part of the mix, and a greater part if, honestly, CO2 is that big of a concern. So, you know, we need to start seeing those types of conversations occur. We need to see, you know, more natural gas. If we're worried about coal and the CO2 emissions with coal, you know, having natural gas as a way to bridge that until we have the other quote-unquote renewable energies in place. But I don't know, Justin, what do you think?
I'm with you. And, you know, as we've spoken about in previous shows, I think liquid natural gas is really going to be that unsung hero that plays such a pivotal role in keeping people warm, but also being a clean way to generate energy. And at the end of the day, that's part of the oil and gas industry.
That's an excellent point. So natural gas definitely going to play a big part. You know, oil will definitely play a big part, like we talked about. But, you know, how big of a part is it going to play, and what are prices going to do? And I know that's been a concern and a question, you know, in a lot of people's minds right now as they're looking at their royalty checks. We are starting to see larger royalties due to the uptick in oil prices. I know that at least the last couple of royalty checks that I've gotten, you know, for production in May for oil, that, you know, it's nice to see $60 on that check, and it's going up because right now crude oil is, you know, right around $74 a barrel.
It is. And the price is slowly creeping up. And, you know, Matt, do you want to talk about what kind of the outlook is for oil and gas and what is causing some of this supply and demand?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the outlook, and we're going to talk a little bit in detail about supply and demand. We'll give you some of the numbers from the most recent EIA short-term energy outlook and some of the statements in there with respect to, North American production versus OPEC. And so we'll break that down for you because I know the OPEC Plus group has been in the news lately. And so this is going to definitely play into what oil prices do in the future as and who's going to actually fill in the gap and meet global demand. And so I think from that standpoint, let's talk about that first and then let's talk about North America specifically. So for the current short-term energy outlook, the EIA mentions that we are currently in the situation where we lost about 8.6 million barrels a day in world liquid fuels consumption in 2020. Again, due to the pandemic, we saw a drop in demand as people were traveling less, as manufacturing facilities were shut down. So we had that decline that we're recovering from. They're forecasting a consumption growth of 5.3 million barrels a day in 2021. So we'll have a little over 3 million barrels a day below where we were when the pandemic hit at the end of this year. And then they expect that to sort of fully recover at the end of 2022. So by the end of 2022, again, assuming global GDP grows and we see the continued growth of consumption of crude oil, then we will be in a situation, I think, sort of towards the end of 2022, I think we will have fully recovered from the dip that we saw in the demand for crude oil and be back above 100 million barrels per day in terms of world liquid fuels consumption. So, from a growth standpoint, we're seeing a pretty quick bounce back, as far as the demand for crude oil, and that's going to factor in, and that'll largely determine what crude oil prices are going to do later this year and into 2022. If we see a decrease, if we see, say, a resurgence, this Delta variant of the coronavirus or other situations where governments impose new lockdowns again this year as we get into the winter, and if we see a spike in cases and things like that, I think that is a possibility that could be a threat to the recovery of demand, which then again would probably hit the price of oil. We'd see oil go down as we get back into an oversupply situation. So I think a lot is dependent on what happens this year with the pandemic, and assuming we see continued recovery, people are getting vaccinated, and we should hopefully not have to worry as much about different variants and causing issues because we'll have more and more people vaccinated. And so we'll have people able to travel and able to go on with their lives. But again, that's a big risk. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Justin?
It is. And I'm glad to see the demand is coming back online and projected to get better and better. But as you mentioned, there's so many things that can impact this, both good and bad. So only time will truly tell.
Yeah, time will tell. And interestingly, to put that into perspective, what do those numbers mean from a demand point of view? And then where are we at from a supply standpoint? So the interesting thing that they're forecasting as well, kind of coupled with that, to meet that growth in demand, they expect to see 2.5 million barrels per day increase on average in 2021, and then a 5.1 million barrels per day increase on average in 2022. Again, that gets you just below the 8 or so that we lost during the pandemic. And the way they break that down, primarily, you're looking at OPEC countries have the majority of that in 2021, a smaller portion shared by both Latin America and North America that are going to fill in the gap of both, well below a million barrels per day increase in 2021. And then getting into 2022, it's a pretty even split where they show North America kind of having about a third of that growth. But then again, OPEC taking a big chunk of that and having really the majority of about 2 million barrels per day in growth on average in 2022. So the big thing here to keep in mind is that we are in a surplus production capacity situation with OPEC. So even if we have a surge in demand for crude oil, I see OPEC really as the entity that's going to fill in the gap in the next year or two. Again, because of what we've talked about on the show before, in the U.S., we're in a different economic market from an oil and gas company point of view. It's harder to borrow money to drill new wells. There's more scrutiny around companies living within their cash flow. So what that means from a drilling activity standpoint is it's going to be stable, and we're going to see continued drilling in the U.S., but it's never going to, I don't think, reach the levels we saw prior to the pandemic. Again, because of these constraints that are being placed on the industry from a money standpoint, you know, it's harder for them to get money to spend on drilling new wells, both from a political standpoint. You know, there's a lot of pressure on companies to reduce their carbon emissions. Oil and gas are seen as quote unquote dirty. And so, you know, where investors are looking to invest their money, they're wanting to invest in renewables just because there seems to be obviously a huge push towards that with the current administration in the U.S. There's likely to be favorable legislation for renewables, subsidies for renewables, whereas we're seeing a lot of headwinds from the administration in the U.S. around anti-U.S. oil and gas regulations. And so we'll talk about that here in a little more detail. But one thing I want to mention is here's a quote from the EIA. They said, even with increased OPEC crude oil production, remaining surplus production capacity will be more than sufficient to meet additional demand should consumption exceed our expectations. We expect that OPEC surplus crude oil production capacity, which averaged 6.2 million barrels a day in 2020, will average 6.7 million barrels a day in 2021 and 4.8 million barrels a day in 2022, compared with average surplus capacity of 2.2 million barrels a day from 2010 to 2019. And so this talks about, doesn't include Iran because of U.S. sanctions, and then everything being equal, that the elevated levels of OPEC surplus production capacity will likely have a moderating effect on crude oil price increases. So I would expect that OPEC is going to come back to the table. They'll eventually increase production to meet demand and to sort of help moderate the crude oil price increases to stabilize it. So I expect that we're probably in a regime right now where we'll see kind of that probably $60 to maybe $75, maybe $80 if we see any sort of geopolitical issues happen. But I think the range that we're at right now is probably a healthy range. It does put pressure and it sort of elevates the discussion a little bit too, I think, around how dependent we are on oil and gas. And if we're limiting production in the U.S., how, you know, that's going to hurt people's pocketbooks, especially those that are struggling to make ends meet. You know, if you're having right now $4 plus gasoline prices, it's hard for people to afford to fill up their car to drive to work. You know, we start to need to have these conversations around, you know, why are we placing these constraints from a government standpoint? You know, would increased activity in the U.S. that would organically occur by letting the industry sort of go through the price discovery process, would that be more beneficial for consumers than imposing restrictions like we saw with Biden trying to place a moratorium on new drilling permits on federal lands and things like that, that are going to artificially restrict the U.S. as to really play a part in that supply growth picture. And, you know, what's that going to mean for U.S. consumers? Because I think people will start to get a little bit fed up when they start to see the hit to their pocketbook. And then, you know, again, once these stimulus checks stop arriving in their bank accounts, you know, I think that's obviously helping moderate some of that right now. But once that stops, you know, we're going to see people starting to get upset that they're having to pay so much at the pump. What do you think, Justin?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it'll be interesting to see if those gas prices at the pump help to control what legislation the Biden administration will potentially pass for different options of controlling oil and gas. And there's been several options that have been talked about that may be open to him that they may explore. But, you know, it's just going to drive those gas prices higher. And I know from talking to the people in my circle, it's certainly noticed.
I agree. Yeah. You know, even I'm going to the pump and it's kind of painful when you pay $70 to fill up your car. I have a SUV and it's not cheap, you know, and we're driving around in the summer going to the mountains and things like that. And so it's not an inexpensive proposition to fill up a vehicle. And we have an article here that I'm going to talk about a little bit because it talks about this specifically. And the article mentions the Biden administration is preparing to release a blueprint for limiting sales of U.S. drilling rights as rising oil and gasoline prices highlight the risk of curtailing domestic crude production, just like we talked about. So interestingly, as we reported in our latest news episode, the federal court overturned the Biden administration's ban on leasing and drilling on federal lands. And so they're going to be looking at other ways to try to restrict U.S. oil and gas development, at least on federal lands where they have control over that. And so they're looking at different ways to do that. And there's going to be, I think, a big push to ask the question, why are we really doing this? You know, is this in the best interest of national security from the standpoint of energy independence? You know, obviously that's a big concern. And then, you know, if our economy is going to rely more heavily on crude produced in foreign nations with, you know, lax environmental controls, you know, how is this helping the climate change situation? To be honest, if we're really that concerned about climate change, you know, we ought to be producing the oil and gas here because we have the most stringent oil and gas or environmental regulations for producers, especially in states like Colorado. You know, world-class, you know, regulations, if you want to consider that a good thing. But, you know, it's one of those things where we have more stringent regulations than if we were to allow OPEC to fill that gap, like we talked about earlier. OPEC, if you go, you know, look at Saudi Arabia and other countries, they do not have those same requirements. And so they're going to be emitting more CO2. There's going to be more fugitive emissions at well sites, you know, from things like small, tiny leaks at different flanges and tanks and things like that, where the U.S. were using thermal imaging cameras to detect that stuff and to stop those leaks from occurring. And so we're really a lot tighter operation from the standpoint of methane emissions and overall just, you know, stricter environmental controls in place. And so, you know, this is something where they are looking at, how do we put these constraints in place to limit growth in the U.S.? Again, I am pretty opposed to that. I consider myself a libertarian from the standpoint of the government should really keep their hands out of free markets and let the system go through and come to the best way of producing energy. And obviously, you need to have some guideposts in place around environmental regulations to make sure that that is controlled for and that is taken into consideration. And we certainly have that in place. So let's just let the industry figure it out. You know, there's going to be, from the standpoint, if you want to drive innovation, there's already a ton of money going into renewables. There's going to be innovation occurring. We need to maintain a level of production, maintain our energy security. We have this amazing supply of oil and natural gas. Let's take advantage of it. So.
Yep, you said it great, Matt. And that's why wouldn't we take that responsibility for improving the way that we're doing things and bringing in new technologies to be cleaner and more efficient? And, you know, the United States has proven that we're good at that. And relying on OPEC in the past has proven that it's not the best idea in the world.
Exactly. And, you know, interesting quote they have in this article. Again, we'll put this link to this article in the show notes. As a quote from the director of the Sierra Club Lands Protection Program, quote, traditionally gas prices have been the big X factor, but the public seems to care about it less in comparison to the consequences of climate change they are experiencing now, Manuel said. If they do make decisions under that frame for climate, we think they're going to get a drilling ban, maybe not in this report, but eventually. So interesting that, you know, this is the narrative that is being pushed by climate activists, and they're using this as the mechanism to get around, I think, the ban. And so I think that they're going to look at trying to go that route. They kind of hinted at where their next step might be. I expect to see a ton of headlines. I expect to see the narrative being all about climate change and how we need to do what we can to combat that. And that'll boil down to try to get another sort of restriction in place around drilling and leasing. And maybe it's going to be in the form of regulations and just making it way more difficult for operators to pull permits and things like that. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, but I think that's an interesting statement that we got to be careful and be looking at a lot of these articles with some scrutiny, because there's a definite narrative out there around climate change, and it's not always tied to the facts and to science, unfortunately.
Yep, unfortunately. And it seems to be one of those things that out of sight, out of mind. All right, Matt, so the million-dollar question. So what's going to be the impact on mineral rights and royalties from what's going on currently?
Yeah, so I think talking about the U.S. specifically, where we are getting royalty checks, you know, I talked about it already. I think we're going to see some stability. We'll see moderated growth, companies living within their cash flow. So you'll see fewer rigs running than we saw in the past. We'll see probably more consolidation as operators look to leverage economies of scale. And, you know, as operators are maybe drilling in the same basin, they might join forces so that they have a larger footprint. They can do more economically drill those wells and leverage maybe some of the midstream components and things like that. So I think that's going to continue. You know, the thing that we see right now from a rig count standpoint, we are roughly at about 475 rigs running in the U.S. versus at the end of 2019, we were at 1,080 or so. So that was the pre-COVID numbers. So we're not quite back to half of where we were pre-COVID. We are up significantly from where we were a year ago. Again, this we're recording this on July 14th, 2021. And a year ago, we were at 212 fewer rigs. So we were at 263, if my math is correct. So we were well below where we are now, but still we are well below where we were pre-pandemic. So have you seen any drilling activity picking up? Are you on minerals, Justin?
No, so everything is maintaining, but I'm not seeing as many new wells being drilled as I was previously. And we had talked a little bit before the show, Matt. I wonder if that's going to be, is that where we're going to see the focus for drilling new rigs if they do? Is it going to be in the formations that are proven to produce, or is that going to come to a screeching halt or a slow crawl as well?
That's a great observation. I do agree that we're going to see continued drilling in the formations that are proven, where they know they can get a good return on their investment. So if you look at the U.S. map and look at the different basins, we'll break it down here. The top 10 counties in over the past 12 months, it's heavily focused on the Permian and Delaware basins. So you have places like Loving County, Reeves County, Martin County, Howard County, Midland County in Texas, and then southern New Mexico, we have Eddy County and Lay County. So that's the majority of the activity is really in Texas and New Mexico. And then follow behind that, we see Louisiana as another sort of area where things are picking up. And again, that's primarily in the Haynesville. And, you know, again, we have other places that, you know, definitely have a lot fewer rigs. If you look, compare Texas right now is 222 out of that 475 rigs running. And there's no other state in triple digits. You have, again, New Mexico is close behind or relatively close at 75, but that's all kind of part of that Permian mix. And then, you know, you look at the map, it's sort of spread between East Texas, Eagle Ford, so kind of South Texas, and then the heavily into West Texas. And then Oklahoma has seen some activity, but again, they're only running 23 rigs right now. And that is primarily looking like it is in Grady County in Oklahoma. And, and again, there's just, you know, rigs, a handful of rigs here and there. Colorado has 13 running in Weld County primarily. a little bit in the Piance Basin and Colorado. We have Utah with a few, California right now, at least for a few, although they're looking to ban fracking, or they have recently. And then, you know, the rest really centered in Wyoming and then North Dakota in the Bakken. So, oh, yeah, I don't want to leave the Marcellus out. So Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, you know, they're definitely seeing some activity as well. So these are all basins, again, like you suggested, Justin, they're proven basins. You know, operators have a history there. They have the infrastructure there already. So then it's just infill drilling that they're doing now and development. So we're not going to see, I think, a ton of exploration where they're going to be making these wild bets on some new formation. There could be some of that continuing organically, but I think it's going to be a pretty small amount, at least from an unconventional standpoint. There's so many locations available to these operators to drill in these proven basins that I think that's going to be the majority of the activity for the foreseeable future.
It makes a lot of sense. And as you've mentioned a couple times in the show, but the access of being able to go and loan money really slows down their ability to drill new wells. And so it'll be interesting to see if we see those come online much slower or how much of that we end up seeing.
Yeah, I expect that, you know, oil prices will play into that for sure. And gas prices, you know, we've seen a resurgence in gas, natural gas prices as well, which we don't want to leave out because that's important. And that's, you know, we're in this middle of the summer, which is historically not a super high gas price time period. Usually in the wintertime, we see that kind of increase in Henry Hub prices as demand for heating and things like that goes up. And so I expect that we're going to see some robust gas prices as well. Similarly, with oil, operators are in the same boat as far as living within cash flow, only drilling the wells that are going to be profitable and where they have infrastructure to take away the gas. And so, you know, I think that's going to be the moral of the story for the next couple of years is moderate growth, not where we were pre-pandemic. I think we're going to see slow increase, a more moderate increase in drilling activity in the U.S. and in North America in general. Again, fueled by an increase in global demand that the U.S. will play a smaller part in filling that gap versus where we were from around 2015 to 2019. And so I think we're going to see a smaller portion of that growth, demand growth filled by the U.S. going forward, again, just because of these restrictions, both from a federal point of view, as well as the market placing restrictions on these companies from a lending and you know, borrowing standpoint and getting funding for drilling those wells. Interesting statistic, when you look at global demand from right around that 2015 time period to 2019, we saw, I think it was around 8 or 9 million barrel a day increase over that time period. And pretty much all of that was filled by the U.S. So the U.S. played a huge role in actually filling that demand gap, so to speak. And again, that was fueled by low cost money. Increase in production is really the big focus for these companies and really drilling as many wells as fast as they could to sort of gain foothold in these basins as they lease them up. And so that those days are over, I think, but we will see a more moderate increase or more moderate growth period going forward that the U.S. will play, I think, a smaller role in actually filling the global demand growth, but you know, an important role at that. So,
and you know, for those mineral right owners that may be considering selling, less drilling and a longer time till having producing minerals is certainly going to lower the value. Isn't that correct, Matt?
You're absolutely right. Yeah. So the biggest driver on the price of mineral rights and royalties is around the timing of development of and drilling of any new wells. So if you had either minerals that are producing, but then they have space for additional infill wells, or if it's non-producing minerals that have space and you're in a proven basin, you know, historically, the way that mineral buyers go and look at valuing these properties is really, it's dependent on when they think those new wells are going to come online, because that'll determine when they're going to get a return on their investment. So if there are permitted wells on your property There's clear line of sight that an operator is going to drill those wells here in the next year or two. That property will demand a higher price than if you were in an area, of course, that was away from that drilling activity with no real line of sight to drilling. You know, there's no permits and that kind of a thing. So we've talked about that before. Biggest driver on the value of minerals and royalties is the timing of new wells coming online. And then, you know, another factor that's going to play into it is if you have, say, you're receiving royalties, property's already been fully developed. In other words, there's no space for any additional wells. You're getting royalty checks. Then in that situation, one of the biggest factors on the value of that property is commodity prices. And so if we're in the same situation we're in right now with the expected continued demand growth, commodity prices expected to stay sort of where they are, I'd say in the mid-60s to mid-70s for oil and around $3 in MCF for gas, natural gas, then you're going to see good prices paid for producing royalties. And, you know, I think that's been a big focus, certainly over the past couple of years, is there's been a lot of uncertainty around what development and what drilling is going to do in the U.S. You see mineral investors really focusing on PDP minerals. So in other words, producing properties, in other words, where you're receiving royalty checks already. And so that's been a big focus. And to the extent that maybe there's some upside potential in those properties, you know, for drilling new wells. And maybe if there aren't permits there, the buyers are going to pay less than they were before for that undeveloped acreage. Again, just because there's expected to be this slower pace of development, this slower growth in drilling activity going forward. So I think that's sort of what we should expect from a minerals market. We'll bring on an expert in that side of things and to talk a little bit more about that here in the near future. We have somebody lined up, but so we'll have a little bit more of a deeper dive on the minerals market and the royalties market and what prices are doing and sort of what the current thinking is around mineral investors and how they're underwriting these properties. So that's kind of where I think we're headed, Justin.
I think that makes sense. And, you know, as an investor, you would certainly want to decrease your risk by knowing that the property is producing, especially in the environment where we're not sure what direction the wind's going to blow. All right, Matt. So the impact of renewables on the future of the oil and gas industry. So this is something we've talked a lot about, but it's ever evolving and, you know, some speculation to see where this is actually going to go.
Yeah, it's certainly getting a lot of press. And I think there's no mistake there. It's not accidental. I think it's an orchestrated move by both environmental activists and then people jumping onto that bandwagon. And, you know, if you think about, if I'm going to publish a story, if it's all, you know, if it's a boring story saying everything's going to be fine, there's really nothing to worry about, people are not going to read it. But if there's this, you know, hysteric, you know, kind of catastrophe scenario that they're painting and the headline is really capturing your attention and you're going to want to read that because you just want to know, okay, what's going to happen? You know, do I need to run and hide? And so that the fact of the matter is, I think we're going to see more headlines like that. We're going to just because they're going to sell more newspapers, they're going to get more page views on the websites by putting those really extreme headlines in place and people are going to want to read about that. So I guess unfortunate situation that we're in, they've sort of figured that algorithm out and, you know, the subject line of the headline of the article is important. And so the more that sensational they can make it, I think the more views that they're going to get, maybe not all fact-based and they're going to find people that back up their ability to continue to writing those headlines. And I'm sure that the environmental movement will continue to supply that because they're wanting to direct the narrative in that direction, whether it is good for humanity or not. That's debatable. We've talked about that a lot in the past around what's driving these types of movements. Certainly not a argument, I don't think, anymore that climate change is occurring, that humans have some role in that. How much is debatable. And then what the future is going to look like, I think, is highly debatable. And a lot of these forecasts are based on incomplete data. You know, they're forecasting out the curve 30 years into the future. Whereas there's incomplete data now, and it's hard to, I think, make a strong conclusion based on those types of forecasts, but people are doing it and they're making, unfortunately, the policy decisions on that. And so I think our current administration is fully bought into that. We have people that are in the inside that are driving that narrative. And we're going to see that continued pressure on the oil and gas industry in the U.S. as we see more mandates being in place around renewable usage, around wind and solar, around reducing the use of crude oil and natural gas. Fact of the matter is, though, you know, to go for transportation, certainly for transporting goods at long distances, you're going to be using fossil fuels for that. Just there's the energy density is much higher, makes a lot more sense. It's cheaper for companies to transport, whether it's on a train that's powered by diesel, whether it's on a ship that's going across the ocean with containers that's powered by petroleum, or you name it. Those are all of our primary modes of transportation use fossil fuels. So that's a big focus, especially as the global economy continues to recover. Then we're going to see continued demand for that. But here in the U.S., I think that we're going to see, again, more focus on investing in renewables, more subsidies and tax breaks in place for those investments. And then the ESG movement is also really focusing on that environmental side of things and really focusing in on building more wind turbines, more solar panels, and really focusing on that full life cycle carbon footprint of those, despite the heavy carbon emissions associated with manufacturing those and the fact that it's also done in China, where there are fewer environmental regulations in place. So I think, again, you're going to see downward pressure on the U.S. oil and gas industry because of all these political and environmental elements. Then globally, though, we see this increase in demand. And I think it really just boils down to what the administration does, how many restrictions they put in place to allow the industry to respond to demand growth. If they artificially suppress the industry's ability to respond to that, then I think we'll be in a situation where we're going to see less growth than the other scenario, where if they open it back up and allow drilling on federal lands and allow things like that to occur. So I think we're going to still need oil and gas as a cheap and reliable source of energy. We're going to need fossil fuels to make wind turbines and solar panels and EVs. And we need those cheap and reliable sources of energy to back up the grid due to the unreliable nature of wind and solar. So as we see an increase in wind and solar capacity coming online for power generation, we're still going to need a good portion of that backed up by coal and natural gas. Otherwise, we're going to get into a situation where we're going to see rolling blackouts and things that we saw in Texas and California in the past. And so that's not going to go away. We do see that minerals and royalties, I think, will still have value for many years to come. I think we have seen a peak in the market prices, though. I don't think we're going to see the high multiples paid for properties like we saw in that 2015 to say 2019 timeframe. There's still going to be value, and there's still value in holding if you don't need to sell. Drilling is still likely going to occur in these basins. It's going to be at a slower pace than it was before. So if you're in a core area of these oil and gas basins that we've talked about in the past, then, you know, it's still, I think, worth holding on. And, you know, there's going to be activity. It's just maybe going to take a little bit longer before a well is drilled than what we were expecting before. But again, you know, I think you're going to see in the core of those hot plays, if you have permits, if you have a operator that's drilling wells right now on your property, you're going to get top dollar for those types of properties versus if you're, again, in an area where you're not near any sort of drilling activity, there's no prospect for near-term drilling anytime soon, then that's going to be harder to get a speculative buyer coming in and paying a lot of money for that. But and so it just, you know, really you need to take your own personal situation into account. There's a lot to be said for holding on to minerals if you don't need to sell them. You know, once a well is drilled in the future, you know, once you start getting those royalties again, if we continue to see oil and gas prices where they are today, then that you can expect a decent royalty check. So, you know, I still think there's value there. Don't panic, I guess, is the moral of the story. So,
you said it great, Matt. It'll be interesting to see, you know, with renewables, how the private market decides to move forward and what kind of incentives are given out to private companies. You know, we may see a different world, but it's certainly going to have to be with the private companies of the United States who are so great at innovation. And, you know, with the coronavirus vaccine, I think it showed what if you get the private companies to cooperate and have them all work together towards a single mission, what can end up happening? But that's what it's going to take to really push towards this energy transition.
Yeah, that's a great note to end this on. I think the U.S. innovation is going to play a big role in sort of solving the world's energy problems, so to speak. And, you know, U.S. producers of oil and gas can play a big role in providing cheap and reliable energy at a world-class environmental impact. So, you know, we can minimize our impact, still produce oil and gas, and especially if we do it here in the U.S. So hopefully that narrative will get more press and we'll get more of an appetite to continue to drill on U.S. soil. But we're in an uphill battle right now, so continue to fight the good fight out there. Thanks again for listening. As always, you'll find links to these articles we talked about today in the show notes, which can be found at mineralrightspodcast.com. And, you know, thanks again. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mineral Rights Podcast with your host, Matt Sands. Don't forget to subscribe and share at mineralrightspodcast.com. The Mineral Rights Podcast should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy.